life gets messy. Spills, stains, and kid chaos. But with Anabe, cleaning up is easy. Our sofas are fully machine washable, inside and out, so you never have to stress about messes again. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics, that means fewer stains and more peace of mind. Designed for real life, our sofas feature changeable fabric covers, allowing you to refresh your style anytime. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa effortlessly. Perfect for cozy apartments or spacious homes. Plus, they're earth-friendly and built to last. That's why over 200,000 happy customers have made the switch. Get early access to Black Friday pricing right now. Sofas start at just $699. Visit washablesofas.com now and bring home a sofa made for life. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
If I have to drunkenly get in the back of one more Uber with a driver who does not know how their throttle pedal works, I'm going to lose my mind.
Hello and welcome back to the Plugged In Podcast, a weekly news show all about the future of transportation. I'm Tim Levin, senior editor at Inside EVs. On this week's show, the EV world has a new problem, too many batteries. And we get an update on what's going on with the Rivian Volkswagen software deal. I just got back from Rivian's offices where I spoke with the co-CEOs of that joint venture, got a tour of their offices, and I will tell you what I learned. Plus, Tesla just lost two leaders of the Model Y and Cybertruck programs. Patrick's on a well-deserved vacation, so here to break this all down with me is our deputy editor, Mac Hogan. Mac, thanks for being on the show.
Hey, Tim. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here, trying to fill in for Patrick, but with a lot less Texan charm.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's kind of a prerequisite. You have to make like a couple of real banger jokes, bring out some of that Texan energy.
Yeah, I'm from the Midwest, so I just brought a casserole. and a nice smile. I'll say ope if you bump into me. That's what I can offer.
Okay, pretty cool. I'll take it.
Great. Well, let's get into it.
Before we get started, as part of our partnership with Hankook Tire, I wanted to point our listeners to the next Electrify Expo event in Dallas, Texas, happening November 15th and 16th. That's this weekend. You can stop by the Hankook Ion booth at the event to check out their EV-exclusive Ion tire lineup with options for a wide array of EVs and learn more about Hankook's experience as the official tire partner of Formula E. We'll have a bunch of exciting content from the event coming to the site and to our social channels soon, so stay tuned. All right, with that, let's get into this week's news. I wanted to start with a story that you actually covered this week, which was super interesting, about overcapacity in the battery world. Basically, there is way more capacity to build EV batteries than there is demand for those batteries. And this is something that's been brewing for a while, something we've known about for some time. But now we have some rather staggering numbers to add to this trend, thanks to a consulting firm, Alex Partners. So according to the firm, there is 1.9 times as much battery manufacturing capacity in North America as there is demand. Basically, we can build twice as many EV batteries as we need right now. In Europe, it's 2.2, and in China, it's 5.6, which is kind of crazy. Even for China, which is kind of like the king of unnatural market dynamics. That is like pretty crazy. There's almost six times the potential supply as there is demand. So Mac, you did this story. Break this down. What is going on here? What does it mean?
Yeah. So let's start with something on directionality, which to start with what's going on. First off, it's getting worse. This is not the highest that number is going to be based on Alex Partners' projections. I think they were saying next year it's going to get worse in North America. I think China is going to peak out a little bit earlier. But generally, directionally, this is a problem that's getting bigger. And that's just because of the same story we've been covering over and over again, which is that a lot of people overestimated how much consumer demand there would be for EVs. And then you have this sort of compounding thing where if everyone overestimates it at the same time, then now you have all of this surge capacity and now you have to figure out what to do with it, right? And that's where automakers are right now. We're already seeing the results of this in China in terms of just how much consolidation and hard times are already facing their industry, how many companies are struggling.
But you know, what Alex Partners was basically saying was that already the number of battery manufacturing firms moving into financially dubious territory, not quite bankruptcy risk, but getting there, is already on the rise. And, you know, with tariffs and the pulling back of tax credits and all of that, I mean, that is probably going to increasingly get worse. So basically, with Alex Partners' projections, they originally projected that the US market would be about 36% EVs for new vehicle share in 2030. And now they're projecting 18%. So, I mean, we've halved that number, which is not great for the climate. And it's not great if you're an EV battery maker. So now we have all this capacity. And the question is, what happens next?
Yeah. So basically, like, all these companies, all these battery companies, they planned ahead for a future that is now less vibrant for EV, a future that's not happening, right?
Right.
Like, they saw tax credits, which for the most part are gone now. They planned all these battery factories, and now, like, you're not selling as many EVs. You just don't need as many EV batteries, right?
Yeah. And I think, I'm quoting from memory here, but I think there was some number of the number of investments that have come out since the Inflation Reduction Act passed in 2022, I believe, or 2021.
Yeah.
Basically 50% of all of the clean energy investments that have ever been made in our economy have been made since then. And now already that support is getting kind of pulled back, and some places were able to take advantage of it, some weren't. You have this weird thing where companies and countries were so aggressive on how much they thought EVs would take off. And, you know, obviously China was huge on incentive spending, but there was big incentives in Europe. There was regulatory pushes in Europe, regulatory pushes here. And just all of that has kind of cracked under this fundamental pressure, which is that people don't want to pay for how expensive these things are. And that was something I talked about with one of the authors of this report, where it's like, okay, we have more supply than demand. So in my extremely rudimentary understanding of economics, you would think that that would lead to low prices. And, you know, his point was, well, yes, prices are low relative to how much it actually costs to produce these vehicles. And that kind of makes sense to me. I mean, my Chevy Blazer EV that I'm paying $8,000 for over 2 years, GM is definitely losing money on that deal. So is the company that makes the battery for them, you know. So you have a lot of these unhealthy transactions that are driven by this weird balance of, okay, we have all this battery capacity and we need to use it, but also the input costs, the actual cost of assembling it, how many hours it takes of labor and logistics cost, and the materials themselves are so high that the vehicles are still too expensive to justify the full capacity of the plant. And then, of course, with the plant running not at full capacity, you're leaving a bunch of money on the table. So it's just kind of all of these things are cascading onto each other. It's not a great time to be building batteries for EVs. The good news is that we've seen a lot of companies announcing deals either to offload capacity to places that can better use it, like, you know, competitors, or things like GM's deal to sort of back out of one of its Ultium plants and hand it back over to LG. And we've also seen some companies convert their battery pipelines towards battery energy storage systems. So that's a huge area of growth, and one that has grown much faster than we expected, as opposed to EVs, which are growing a little slower than expected. So
yeah,
it's not all bad news, but it's not great.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely the pivoting is something we've seen from a bunch of companies, right? So like this month, this JV between LG and Stellantis said it won't start making EV batteries for a while. It'll instead shift focus to batteries for energy storage, which are becoming like more and more important because of, you know, AI demands, other energy demands, just being able to like store energy,
balance the grid
from solar, stuff like that. So we'll probably see more of that. I mean, so what does happen next with this? You know, you said Alex Partners expects this, basically the mismatch, to grow in North America, right, over the next few years. But like, what do they expect to happen? Because one of the interesting things was, we actually need, like, we have overcapacity of batteries, right?
Yeah.
But we also need more batteries of certain types, like LFP. We need cheaper batteries. But this creates an environment where, like, you don't really want to invest in building more batteries if there's already too much capacity, right? So what did they kind of say about, like, where this goes next?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a couple things going on where, you know, globally, the whole EV battery market is controlled by a very small number of companies. I mean, it's things like Panasonic, LG Energy Solutions, CATL. Those companies control a large percentage of the overall market. And that's true in North America, But, you know, one of the things that we were talking about with this report was North America is particularly, it has a problem with the geographic spread. There's just, there's not as many factories spread out as there are in, you know, China. And there's so many companies that are reliant on a single source of battery providing a single chemistry type that, yeah, there's not a lot of, if you are an American manufacturer and say, I want an LFP battery that's not built in China, and I want to go buy it, you know, from someone who has spare capacity, you're not going to really find that. So the point was, we're going to see a lot more, a lot less investment in scale as the way that we solve these problems and more of driving towards profitability. So we have things like GM and Ford working on lithium manganese rich cells that could maybe drive down prices while keeping this sort of general performance characteristics of like an NCM battery. And then, yeah, we have pivots towards LFP, which already we're seeing like the Chevy Bolt is going to be LFP. And then, yeah, you have a lot of these, like, you're going to see things like these weird deals of companies leasing capacity to each other or swapping out batteries. But yeah, a lot of the challenge here too is just that battery infrastructure isn't that flexible. So you don't want to have a ton of it for chemistries now where like when it, if we do get to solid state batteries, like that's not going to be the same supply chain. It's not going to be the same, you know, actual physically manufacturing area. So there's a lot of challenges for them to solve there. But in the short term, it looks like fewer investments. You're going to see a lot less groundbreaking and more consolidation and creative usage of existing capacity to push towards energy storage systems and things like that. And I think companies like Tesla and GM are sort of bellwethers for this because of how integrate, like how they've been driving demand for their own energy products and how that's going to keep moving as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically switching from like, let's build as many batteries as we possibly can because EVs are exploding, and to more of a like, let's, you know, take stock of the infrastructure we have, the factories we have, and figure out how to like use them in a way that doesn't bankrupt all of us.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, there's creative things already going on there in terms of like, I know I keep harping on the GM stuff just because I've been recently updated on it, but the, you know, GM is using old Ultium packs in energy storage systems in, you know, as sort of a second life for batteries. So that's a super valuable thing. So there's a lot of capacity coming online. And I think having
time for a sofa upgrade, introducing Anabe sofas, where designer style meets budget-friendly prices. Every Anabe sofa is modular, allowing you to rearrange your space effortlessly. Perfect for both small and large spaces, Anabe is the only machine washable sofa inside and out. Say goodbye to stains and messes with liquid and stain resistant fabrics that make cleaning easy. Liquid simply slide right off. Designed for custom comfort, our high resilience foam lets you choose between a sink and feel or a supportive memory foam blend. Plus, our pet-friendly, stain-resistant fabrics ensure your sofa stays beautiful for years. Don't compromise quality for price. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your living space today. Sofas start at just $699 with no-risk returns and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get early access to Black Friday now. The biggest sale of the year can save you up to 60% off, plus free shipping and free returns. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
It's never too early for Lowe's Black Friday deals. Snag some of our biggest savings of the season right now, like 25% off select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees. And get yourself free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit before the Black Friday rush. Because everyone loves free stuff, right? Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 12/3 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
It's not great if you're a battery manufacturer. It's not great if it's not going to solve any problems for you right now if you're a consumer looking. But in general, having too many batteries is a good problem. That means that, okay, everyone has said that we couldn't make enough batteries to satisfy demand. That's not true, obviously. And the next step is like, okay, we have the batteries. You know, we're scaling this. We're driving towards profitability. What's the next step? And I think that's where we're going to see new chemistries, new technologies. And it's going to be a good time to be paying attention to this.
Yeah. Yeah, you're so right. There was like a couple of years ago, people were asking the question. They were like, is there enough lithium? Is there enough? Could we possibly make enough batteries for this transition? It's like, yes, that very quickly. I don't think that was ever correct, but very quickly it switched to like, yeah, we definitely can and we have too much.
Yeah. There was an interesting argument I saw similarly, like, can the grid take it? Was a sort of common refrain about this. And there's an interesting thing I saw about how rolling out air conditioning to the United States was the largest stress on our grid ever. And that basically went from you have no hydro appliances at all, right? Because all of your cooking was gas at that time. You basically, I mean, at that time, electricity is running lights, right? Like that's kind of it.
Yeah.
And then you have to upgrade houses to be able to support air conditioning and then the power system to support that. And so like Florida had to build sort of from scratch with that. And like, we can do it. The beauty of capitalism is if you want to sell someone electricity and you have a buyer for it, someone's going to make that market, right? So I think it'll all work out. It's just the near-term stuff is just none of these markets are mature. No one knows how to make money on it yet. Nobody knows how to figure it out. The technology is still in its infancy, but it does seem like that's the next chapter is integrating all of this together.
Yeah. Yeah. Air conditioning. This is what I always say when people make that accusation. Yep. Air conditioning and refrigeration. These are two times when like we didn't need to use that much electricity, like nearly as much electricity until those came around. And like, did it destroy the electricity grid? No, like we just figured it out. Okay, let's move on to Rivian and Volkswagen. It's been 1 year since Rivian and the Volkswagen Group struck this partnership to work on software-defined vehicle architectures for future electric cars. And now we know where progress stands. I went to Rivian's offices in Palo Alto today, and I learned all about what's happening. So I will give you the lowdown first. I know you already kind of know what's going on, but then I want to hear your thoughts. First off, we can just talk about, like, I think this is a super cool, just like every time I remember that this exists, it's just like such a cool joint venture. It is one of the youngest and most innovative and smallest car companies that manage to reel in like the one of the biggest and most experienced car companies on the planet, just because Rivian like knows how to do software and electronics, and Volkswagen has not really figured that out in any kind of major way.
And Volkswagen knows how to build cars in a way that Rivian is still trying. You know, like I think this is a weird. There's so many cases, especially in the automotive world, because capital constraints drive so much integration. That there's so many cases where you look at two companies coming together, and I'll use the obvious example of Nissan and Honda, and you're just like, how? What?
Yeah.
Like, what are we doing here? And Rivian VW was one where I never saw coming, but it makes a lot more sense. VW just kind of moves slow. They were really struggling with this CARIAD stuff, their own software stuff. And at the same time, Rivian struggled with serviceability and, you know, just the core aspects of repairability, car building, access to Europe. So they kind of have this...
access to capital. Like they needed money. Scale
money
up.
Is the big one for sure.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really interesting. But the shape of it to me has been a little ambiguous up until today. But you sort of got a lot more on that. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, no, I agree. It has been kind of like, okay, they're working together on software and electrical architectures, but like what exactly does that mean? Today we learned a lot more about kind of where things stand. So for some background, for people who don't know, this $5.8 billion joint venture is developing shared electrical architectures for future Rivian and Volkswagen Group EVs. This means cars from Volkswagen, Audi, Porsche, Bentley, Lamborghini, you know, Scout Motors, all of the group's brands will all use versions of this same streamlined zonal computing architecture that was developed by Rivian and is now being kind of worked on by the two companies together. Compared to conventional cars, they'll have a smaller number of more powerful computers that each handle a specific zone of the car instead of a specific like function or domain of the car. And the promise of this and what we've seen in Rivian's is that this should allow for richer software features and a lot more over-the-air updates. And like, you know, I think just to start, like we do see that in Rivian's, right? Like if they can pull this off, if they can make Volkswagens and Porsches and stuff that have that same sort of, you know, feeling you get in a Rivian, I think it'll be worth it. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So the news this week, is that this JV, Rivian Volkswagen Group Technologies, they have, thank God, come up with a shorter name for it, RV Tech.
How many meetings do you think they had about RV versus VR? I guess you can't do VR.
Yeah, exactly, right? No, you can't do VR. It's true. I thought you were going to say how many meetings did they have where they proposed like awful right. names like Stellantis.
Rivian. And, yeah, oh, true. You know,
yeah, but like they're trying to come up with a name.
The meaning of whether Rivian or Volkswagen comes first in the name. Maybe RJ just walked in and was like, hey, you guys came to us. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it's called RV Tech. It now has over 1,500 employees. A lot of those were former, you know, came from Rivian. We're just like the Rivian software and electronics team. And they're getting ready to start on-road testing of their first engineering mules of cars from VW, Scout, and Audi. These are going to be the first few Volkswagen Group cars that get the Rivian technology, the Volkswagen ID Everyone, which is their like cheap, you know, little hatchback that's coming. That's going to be the first one. And then a Scout and an Audi. So what else did I learn today? Wasim Ben Said, Rivian's chief software officer and also a co-CEO of this venture, told me that the electrical architecture concepts for all of these cars are finalized. Took them a year. Now they've figured out like what these should look like. They're working on the next steps. The Volkswagen will have one zonal ECU because it's a small car with not, you know, it's a small, cheap car, doesn't have as much like functionality features as a Rivian or a Porsche or something. The Scout and the Audi will have three, similar to Rivian's Gen 2 R1 vehicles. So I'll stop there. That's kind of like the big updates we got today. So what do you think so far about kind of the progress here? And like, we talked a little bit about it already, but like, if you have more thoughts on just this partnership.
Yeah.
What do you think?
My understanding going into today was that this was almost going to be like a stopgap solution for VW of like, CARIAD had been so troubling for so long that we need a Rivian we need to basically adapt their architecture onto our stuff just until we can learn how to swim in this new river. Clearly, that's not what's going on. I was incorrect there. It sounds like, from what you told me, that the this architecture is going to underpin all VW EVs in the future, which to me is a huge step change, because you see a lot of joint ventures and projects in this industry that are very clearly structured in a way that one company can sort of extract itself. Perfect example would be Honda and GM with like the Prologue thing. They talked a big game about how this was going to be a big project. They were going to make affordable EVs together. But the one thing they actually did was a badge job. So when Honda wants to walk away from the ZDX, it's very easy to do that. That does not seem to be the structure of what's going on here, which surprised me. So it seems like Rivian and VW are really integrating to a level that I did not expect. And I think that that could be really good for both companies. What I'm surprised by is, you know, that Volkswagen sort of doesn't want this, or maybe they will on the side, but I thought that they would still maintain their own projects on the side to basically have redundancy and indigenous capability, stuff that they own that they don't have to license from a JV. But obviously I'm not inside the deal, so that's, you know, I might not understand how it's structured. But it seems like they're really, really betting big on this. And, you know, we know it's an absolute lifeline for Rivian. So to me, this just, the whole thing sounds a lot more serious than I expected. And it sounds more important. And I think it's a real honest look from Volkswagen at like, what does the future of being a car company mean? Because I think a lot of what these companies are struggling with is just that like the core fundamental things you have to be good at in this era are just so different than what they used to be. And what's surprising to me is only that, you know, VW is so leaning into this, and that I would think that it would be more important to them to develop the ability to also do this on their own, disconnected from Rivian. And the fact that they're not doing that proves that this is going to be a long-term commitment. But anyway, you know, with this news, and obviously Volkswagen is also working with the Chinese company XPeng, where they're doing a similar thing where VW appears to be the student in the relationship, learning from XPeng how to make Chinese market cars that are software-defined vehicles. And they're working with Mobileye on their, you know, autonomous vehicle testing. And this has always been the German strategy, to contract out with a couple trusted partners. You know, Bosch has always been integral to their whole, you know, Volkswagen's whole empire too. But it, to me, the question is, what does the Volkswagen brand mean? Has always been the problem for me in the US. And if Rivian
is the tech leader that's driving your software architecture. And if Mobileye is driving your autonomy stuff, well, that the upgradability, the software stack, the autonomy stuff, that's all very central to the experience of an EV. And I just, you know, Volkswagen needs to make sure that it's also carving out its own capability to differentiate its products, because I think that's going to be a huge challenge for all these automakers in the next 10 years is like, okay, everyone's got a perfect powertrain, great range, great efficiency. How do you make your car feel different? And hopefully this gives them the flexibility to do that on the software end, but they have to really make sure that it's not just VWs and Rivians feel the same, but the company can't move as fast as if they were separate.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it's good points. I think what they'd probably say is like, well, we're a half owner with Rivian in this joint venture, 50-50 owners. So like, yeah, Rivian's definitely kind of the, you know, Rivian's the one bringing the expertise here, but they do technically like own, you know, co-own the IP.
Yeah.
So yeah, and to your point, like they are, like this is just for EVs. So this is for, I say,
yeah,
just,
that's true.
That's a, it's still a big deal. Like I wasn't right. totally aware until today that, yeah, it's going to be every new, every future Volkswagen Group EV is going to use this technology. Right. There are not going to be Volkswagen Group EVs that don't. However, the gas cars will not have this joint stuff. So yeah. Presumably they're figuring out how to do software themselves in some capacity.
Yeah, and I had heard that Rivian in general doesn't want to deal with making a version of their platform that's like backwards compatible with gas cars. Because one of the things that's a benefit of being a software-defined company, right, is the you don't have to support gas vehicles. Sorry, not a benefit of a software-defined company, but an EV-only company. They don't have to support gas vehicles, which, for instance, have a much more limited 12-volt battery capability of like, how are you going to upgrade over the air if the battery dies during the process, you break the vehicle. Like, you know, Rivian knows more than most companies how difficult it is to manage 12 volt battery float on a
yeah.
on a gas vehicle and an internal combustion when you can't just fire the traction battery to trickle charge yourself. It's a lot harder. So I think that is already a good sign that they've set themselves up for success there, because I think if you were trying to integrate Rivian software methodology into like existing Porsche, you know, gas vehicle designs, you'd be up a creek without a ladder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I will say, like, I just remembered you. So you mentioned like, it seems like they're working together on this more than yeah. you expected. Yeah. I think same here. They're opening an office in Berlin. Anecdotally, there were a bunch of Germans in the Palo Alto office, like working on this stuff together. And one of the other things I learned was that basically the joint venture will take care of like the initial execution for each of these brands. Like they'll make the architecture, the platform for like the first Audi, the first Porsche, whatever. Mm-hmm. But then after that, it's going to be up to each of those brands to develop it moving forward. So like any OTAs, like those are mm-hmm. all going to be. Over-the-air software updates are just going to be like, okay, if Porsche, you want to do it, like you figure out, obviously, I'm sure you can call up the JV and like, yeah, for help. But like, in theory, like they're supposed to work on these OTAs themselves because it's brand specific, yeah. right? Like they're going to want a different features, different cadence. And same thing with like future models, you know,
yeah.
the JV develops the first Porsche and then Porsche kind of runs with it from there. That's what I learned from, the Volkswagen side CEO of this venture.
If that's true, then if I were Volkswagen, I would want to rotate as many of my own software people through that building as possible.
Yeah.
Because I think the number one thing that Volkswagen needs to learn from Rivian is just the pace. I think that the American software-defined companies and the Chinese companies just move so much faster. I mean, I was amazed getting in an ID Buzz, how many of the flaws of the ID4 that had come out 4 years before just weren't addressed, because it's like, oh no, we're addressing that in our next step change, but we only do our big step changes every 4 to 7 years. So just in between that, there's no over the air update, there's no camp mode, there's no nothing. And I think that is such a structural vulnerability for legacy automakers across the board, and good on Volkswagen for recognizing it and bringing in Rivian. But if its own separate engineers are going to be driving that upgrade process, then we want to make sure that's moving closer to modern Rivian speed than modern, you know, Volkswagen speed, if you could swing it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. It'll be really interesting to see how they take that and run with it, or if they can take that and run with it. I think one of the most interesting things that I learned today was, so Wasim, he said at this event that he thinks this technology could be the, quote, reference operating system for the entire auto industry. So basically, I was like, what do you mean? Basically, license it out like Google does with Android, you know, develop the underlying platform, basically the underlying, like, electronics, the software that kind of ties it all together.
Yeah.
And then, like, if you're Ford or whatever, he didn't mention any specific brands, but, like, if you're another automaker that needs higher end, more advanced software and electronics than you have right now, you come to the Rivian Volkswagen JV and order it or license it out. So, I mean, what do you think about that? Like, well, I guess first I'll clarify. He said they see a lot of opportunity, but they're focusing on, like, the existing, the cars that they're trying to put out. They're focusing on that right now, right. The R2, the Volkswagens, et cetera. But then in the future, like, they see this as a big opportunity to be a supplier or a tech licensor to a bunch of the industry. What do you think about that?
I will start by, you know, couching this in the fact that I'm not a software expert and I don't actually understand the ins and outs of the process of integrating vehicle software. Huge caveat aside. My baseline read.
Caveat, no idea what the fuck I'm talking about.
No idea what I'm talking about.
But I will go, but I will go ahead.
I think I have a better than layman understanding of these things, but a worse than a, you know, someone that's actually doing it understanding of it. To me, you know, that's what I would say if I was in that position, for sure. And I think there is a path for that. Do I think it's the most likely path we're on? Personally, I have yet to see something on the, like, the actual, the UI and the software side of Rivian's is amazing. And I think it does really well. But I don't see enough to tell me that, like, the actual, the way they integrate this all together is some secret sauce that other people can't replicate. And to me, the problem you're going to run into with this is just that, like, the electrical architecture of the car is the car. I mean, if it's how you communicate signals and it's what you can interpret, like, it has to be so tied into your central computer that, like, if you're a VW and you just structurally can't do this, then, like, okay, great, we'll go spend your money and you can do that. But I just don't know that the companies that can't do this are going to still be worthwhile clients in the long term, because, like, ultimately your ability to drive value in an electric vehicle comes with how well you can take advantage of the platform that you have. And if you don't control your platform, and specifically if your platform is controlled by a competitor, right? Because it's like being the Android of EVs, which I know we mentioned was sort of kind of an idea that they're kicking around.
Yeah. Yeah.
Makes sense in the context of, you know, at the high level, but Google, until the Pixel came out, which was not the main thing, like, Google primarily was a software supplier, and then later on they also started doing hardware. I think moving the other way is kind of a challenge, because, like, is Ford going to want to buy EV truck architecture from a company that's making rival EV trucks? Like, how do you provide better motor control and integrate new features that Rivian doesn't support if you are Ford and you're asking Rivian to design features for you? And if you have to spec out how this feature is going to work and how it all integrates across your platform, I would think you would just want to own that. Like, the whole the whole reason Rivian is where it is, the whole reason Tesla is succeeding, is because they're vertically integrated. So when you remove that benefit, I'm just not convinced that the underlying tech stack is so unbelievably ahead of the curve that other people can't make it happen their own. But I do think there will be companies, Stellantis, that are struggling here. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there will be companies that there's a value proposition for. I just think, in the same reason I support Rivian not having CarPlay, if you can't build software, if you can't build software architectures, if you can't build electrical architectures, if you can't build cutting-edge software-defined products, it's going to be a really, really hard decade for you. And, you know, partnering with Rivian might get you through that, but I think with Volkswagen already taking advantage of so much of their learnings, it's like, okay, so am I going to if I'm BMW or if I'm Ford, am I going to want the same technology that's in a Rivian or a VW? I'm not convinced, but we could still see that, you know, work out for them. A lot of it depends on just how difficult this is for everyone else to try.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think you're right. I don't know enough about it to know how far ahead of the curve they are, but that's what they, that's their argument is like, look, yeah, like everybody would want to develop this themselves, but we've been doing it for years and like, we're willing to sell it to you or we're willing to sell it to other companies. So like, yeah, like we see a big opportunity there. I think you're right that like these, you know, there's a reason that all these companies try to have been trying to do more in-house in this, right, in this era is like, yeah, they, you don't want to have too much shared with, you yeah. know, every Volkswagen brand and yeah. Rivian.
Right.
So yeah, it'll be interesting to see if they can sell that to people.
If it was like the absolute key to unlocking, you know, the best possible EVs, like why would you be giving it away anyways? Like Tesla doesn't offer, like the zonal architecture thing specifically is interesting to me because it, Rivian popularized that term, but it's like a, it's naming a trend that's sort of already been happening that started with Tesla.
Yeah.
And it was, I had an interesting conversation with Mercedes engineers because I was like, hey, so is this GLC prototype I'm driving? Is this a software-defined vehicle? Because BMW says iX3 is software-defined. It's a software-defined vehicle. I believe they say zonal architecture for that as well. Do they?
I think so.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Mercedes doesn't. And they're like, well, so we don't say software-defined vehicle. I don't know why. They couldn't tell me why. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of meetings about it. But, you know, they're like, yes, this is a software-defined vehicle. We don't use zonal architectures. We use domain-specific architecture that is still a software-defined vehicle because we're controlling the whole software stack. And their point was like, whether you structure it domain-based or zone-based is not this like key driver of mm-hmm. all later decisions. It's more just like a philosophy approach. And I just thought that was interesting because I think there's a lot of assumption around, okay, Rivian is better at doing tech, therefore Rivian tech is better than other tech in all of these circumstances. And I think one of the reasons that Rivian has such amazing tech is they have a small team that worked really hard on a product that they understand completely. They know their customer, they're in tune with their customer. And all of those advantages they have, I think, derived from the fact that they're a top-down, software-defined, mission-driven company. And if they start being like a contract firm that's also doing like electrical architectures for Ford, I just don't think that that's like going to have the secret sauce the way that like Rivian has. I want a Rivian, you know?
Yeah.
But also the boring companies are the ones that make the money.
Yeah. No, I think it'll be really interesting to see if like we've all been in Rivians. I also want a Rivian. Like they have this very charming and very like cohesive feel, same as like a Tesla. And we'll have to see if like a Volkswagen ID1 or a you know the Audi whatever it's going to be has that same feeling, because ultimately a lot of that comes down to what does the brand do
right
to the, you know, the kind of top layers of that, right? What does the interface look like? How does everything feel and work together? Not all that is going to be Rivian.
Yep, definitely. Yeah, so speaking of which, how are things going over there at Tesla?
Oh, very, very good segue. You've listened to this show before. Yeah, things at Tesla perpetually not going amazing. Leaders of the Tesla Cybertruck and Model Y programs just quit on the same day earlier this week. Siddhant Awasthi spent 8 years at Tesla and most recently led the Cybertruck and Model 3 programs. Emmanuel Lamakia also worked there for 8 years, was most recently the vehicle program manager for the Model Y, leading the ramp up of the new version. Both of them announced that they're leaving. Neither had any ill will, it seemed like, toward the company, and neither mentioned what they were doing next. But I feel like it's hard not to see this in the context of the bigger shift happening at Tesla, which is that it's transitioning away from cars and it's transitioning toward a future defined by robotics and AI. And so in that, you know, I don't have any inside knowledge into these fellas and why they left, but like, yeah, you might lose some of your automotive talent if you don't really want to be a car company anymore. That's my take. What do you think?
My take is that Tesla The fact that it didn't seem to be any ill will or any like explosive fallout or like, oh, this person left after this crisis. Yeah. I mean, this just shows a trend that I've seen with Tesla play out for a long time. It's a company that just systematically does not know how to keep talented people there. And like they attract so much talent and they work them very hard and they get amazing results of them. And then 2 years later, they're gone. And I think that that's a very startup culture in a way that I think probably Elon Musk sees as good too, of like, I have friends that have done this where you graduate a good school and then you work 2 years for an Elon Musk company and you get, your ass kicked and then you're set for a lot. It's like doing 2 years of Goldman or whatever. But I do think at the senior level, all of these, like, that's why I think a lot of people write it off, is there's a lot of companies that use the strategy of like, we don't care if we burn you out, we work people hard and we get them out. But Tesla specifically seems to really bleed top level talent. And that's a couple things. First of all, from my understanding of Elon Musk companies, like the pay is not incredible or anything. Like it's not like they're showering you with money relative to the rest of the industry. You also
a lot in stock.
Yes.
Which does help. Yeah.
Does help. But you have a, very high pressure workplace. But yeah, it does seem like a lot of the company has very specific things that it gets excited about. And then other things that sort of, and there are some teams that are extremely quiet and just, vehicle development engineers that have been there for a long time plugging away in the background. And there's some teams with constant turnover. So I don't see this as much of a new trend, but I do think, it coming at this time where like Model Y, Cybertruck, and Model 3, all of those are products that have had significant reworks within the last couple of years. And all of them are products that already need more. Like Cybertruck is not exciting anymore. So like if you were a normal car company, you'd be pushing special editions and trying to drive up demand that way and drive down cost.
Or you'd be making the next, the mid-size Cybertruck, Cyber Mini.
Right, right. You'd be onto these other things. And yeah, they just don't. I mean, I noticed that. I don't know how much of this is, my own perception changing versus the cars, but I remember driving a 2017 Model Y, or sorry, 2017 Model S P100D. And then the next Model S I drove was not until like 2022. 2023, right before I came here for Road and Track Performance EV of the Year, I drove a Plaid. And what I was surprised by was that the vehicle dynamics over that 6 or 7 years, in my, again, could have been misremembering, but it seemed like it had gotten worse because their development and dynamics team had a lot of turnover and their old engineers that were poached from other companies weren't there anymore. But I think that was the other point that I was going to make about why you see a lot of turnover. One of it is just the conditions of working on Tesla. The other two is, we've seen this just interviewing GM executives, right? Tesla is a very high profile place to poach talent from. There's just like, mm-hmm. if you're the vehicle leader on Model Y, people are going to take your call, for literally anything. So hopefully it's just that these people got, offered at places that worked out well, but it still leaves Tesla in a weird place because you can't be a mature company without having institutional knowledge of yourself. And there's a lot of the play it fast and loose things. I mean, I think this is just in general why it's hard for a startup to mature into an entrenched player. And Tesla specifically doesn't want to do that. They don't want to be GM, right? And so you have like the leader who kind of doesn't want them to become a car company. So cars aren't going to be the focus. And then you have a management strategy that just isn't the sort of risk-averse, long-time horizon plan that you normally see at automotive companies. So it's a different environment.
Yeah. So you're right. There have been a bunch of high-level departures in recent months. Tesla lost its head of manufacturing and sales in North America and Europe, Omid Afshar, who was this like long-time, very close, confidant of Elon Musk, lost the director of its battery team, lost its head of robotics, which is like crazy since that's what they want to do long term. Lost the head of its Dojo supercomputer division, which was recently dissolved.
And how many autopilot or whatever, I feel like we've seen a lot of departures around different teams throughout overall, like that point there about the robotics department leader. I mean, how are you pushing towards the most profitable product of all time and you can't keep the guy in charge of it at the company? Like,
yeah,
I just, it is such a structural risk because then you also have this external. I mean, you have what's happening right now as we speak, which is I see people leaving and I put it in my head that like, oh, well, Tesla just executives always leave. So then, well, if you talk to somebody who's, you know, executive at General Motors, who's weighing a job there or whatever, it's like, well, it doesn't seem like it's a good place to work. You know, like what you present out to the world matters. But I think Tesla doesn't want lifers. Tesla doesn't want people who work there for 15 years and like have a bunch of institutional knowledge, but don't feel like they have to work 80 hours a week. They want people who are young and hungry and are going to give everything to the company. And then when you're done, you're done.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different way of managing.
All right. Well, that's not all the big Tesla news we have to talk about. This is a little old, but I feel like we have to because it's just such a big number. You may know what I'm talking about. Last week, Tesla shareholders approved Elon Musk's big pay package, which could be worth $1 trillion over time if he meets certain benchmarks. Mac, your thoughts beyond the eye roll that I just saw. For our audio listeners, what are your thoughts?
I don't have any thoughts. I mean, it's $1 trillion. What are my thoughts on unicorns getting universal healthcare? Like, it just doesn't, it's, no, at no point in my life is my core faith in just the underpinning of our money made less sense to me than a company that doesn't have $1 trillion paying a guy who also doesn't have $1 trillion, $1 trillion for doing a bunch of stuff that he's seems like not going to do, but probably will still get paid for. I don't know. I'm happy for him. I think, you know, I just hope all the shareholders had a good time at the meeting and that, you know, I'm so divorced from the thinking behind being an activist shareholder for Tesla that it's hard to imagine pushing for this plan. But
yeah,
I also do understand that after driving a Model Y with FSD and like their full vertical integrated energy system and just the whole top to bottom, I mean, they are in a better position than any car company in the world in terms of having made the right bets on the right things at the right times. And
yeah,
now should be the time where they capitalize on all of that. And to me, the cracks are already showing that that's not happening because the company is being mismanaged. But I also understand that this guy pulls off a lot of miracles. And I never thought FSD was going to get as good as it was this weekend driving me around. So, you know, if I talk shit about this $1 trillion pay package, I'm sure in 10 years I will regret it because somehow he'll get an even more, even bigger number. But yeah, I don't have much.
Yeah.
Shareholders are going to do what Tesla shareholders do, which is pay Elon Musk as much as he wants.
I guess I disagree in that I totally do get why, like, I am also divorced from the thinking because I don't own Tesla shares. And I also think there are big cracks in this company, but like, I do understand why they voted this through,
sure,
which is that, you know, these shareholders,
this guy.
Yeah. They've made a ton of money.
Yeah.
You know, it's turned kind of regular people into millionaires because
right,
they bet on Tesla. They saw him on Twitter. They bought stock and now they just like made a ton of money. And without him, like the magic around Tesla, all the hype is gone, right? If you put in a regular like Joe Schmo car company CEO, maybe you'll get some new Tesla models, but like you won't be worth $1.5 trillion. You'll be worth, you know, $100 billion, which is already more than other car companies, but like probably more in line with what it should be worth. So
yeah,
of course they voted it through. Like they need it to keep, they need that stock to keep going up.
Also the company was advertising. Yeah. I mean, I think this is why, you know, for all of my discredited, I'm not a big Elon Musk fan. I'm not a big fan of how the company operates. But I think it's very, very unwise to underestimate how well he plays the game in terms of like people call him stupid and all these things. But I think one really, maybe it was smart, maybe it was an accident, who knows the brilliance, but you know, part of, there's a natural progression that the guys who disrupt and blow up the industry are usually not the guys who are best to like be the you know, the people who are running things sort of in the day to day, right? Your Steve Jobs is not Tim Cook. They're different people.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve Jobs was good for his time and Tim Cook is good for his time. And I think Elon Musk has done a good job of making sure that Tesla stays so fast and so sort of nebulous that there's always some weird crisis or promise that only he could really deliver on. Like, yeah, if you just wanted to drive up margins in the core auto business, I could give you the name of 15 people who could do that, right? But like, if you're trying to also reinvent AI and ride sharing services and robotics all at the same time, like there's only one guy who seems to be interested in doing all of those things. Like, if you believe in Tesla's plan, which by being a Tesla shareholder, I would say you must, then of course you have to believe in Elon Musk. He's the only guy. I don't know that any company can do all of the things he has promised to do, but I do think Tesla is only going to ever maybe deliver on those promises if it's him, because I think other people would just be like, hey, I have the world's best EV manufacturer. I'm going to do that rather than trying to, you know, make humanoid robots. But, you know, all of those jokes about humanoid robots, look, I mean, Hyundai owns Boston Dynamics and GM just made a bet on that, right? So, like, the company definitely has a lot of irons in the fire, but you know, Elon is going to get his payday for paying attention to all those fires.
Yeah, well, maybe. And I think the other thing is, like, a lot of people see, I'm no, you know, Musk apologist, but like, people see the trillionaire number and they forget that he needs to do a lot to get that. Like, yeah. I personally do not think he will get that because he needs, like, in order to get the full money, full package, he needs to hit a bunch of these milestones, including market cap milestones.
Yeah.
So he needs to add $7 trillion in market cap to Tesla. He needs to get Tesla up to $8.5 trillion in order to unlock the full package, which is like...
Yeah. How much of
probably not going to happen. And also, like, if he does do that, does he maybe deserve a trillion? Like, maybe that would mean he just, like, you know, made a shit ton of money for Tesla shareholders.
Do unicorns deserve universal healthcare? I don't know what the value of a guy who creates an $8 trillion company is, right? Because I don't believe that one company should whatever. But yeah, no, I mean, I think you're right. If he can do that, how much of the voting control side of it is tied up in the performance benchmarks, though? Because to me, I personally also believe, like, I don't believe Elon Musk is driven by money. I have a lot of questions about the guy, but I do think he wants to make the world a better place in his own specific way. And I think this package is way more about making sure he can't be pushed out of Tesla and maintain control than it is about, I genuinely, even for someone that rich, the difference between like $400 billion and a trillion, like, he can buy whatever the hell he wants anyway. So I don't think it's that as much as just keeping him in control. And, you know, again, all of my criticisms of Tesla's business practices and him, like, he's built it. I don't think it's insane that he should control it. And that the numbers are so ridiculous is honestly a factor of his own success. You have to promise a multi-trillion dollar market cap because you've already delivered $1 trillion market. You know, like, there's so much... value that he's created, and I just, it's so disproportionately impactful to the size of the actual auto business at this point that it's just, I mean, I could try to comment as someone loosely trained as a financial reporter, but like, generally, I just don't understand.
same.
There's nothing like sinking into luxury. Anabe sofas combine ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. Anabe has designed the only fully machine washable sofa from top to bottom. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash. Perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabe has you covered. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your home. Sofas start at just $699. And right now, get early access to Black Friday savings, up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion. It's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
All right, now it's time for Plus Minus, our segment where we talk about who's up and who's down in the EV world. Mac, you're up first.
Sure, yeah. So I'm going to start with just plus. I'm going to say who's up is all of us, but specifically used EVs. I want to call out a story Suvrat did about how, you know, the fastest selling cars on the used market right now are electric cars. And I think that's exactly right. I think if you want a vehicle and you want to spend under $30,000 and you want a recent vehicle, like a relatively recent off-lease EV is like the best deal ever. And I want to tie that into this battery capacity story that we talked about, because I think another thing is the number one thing that I still hear from people who are afraid of used EVs is like, what do I do when the battery goes bad? And the first answer is like, what do you do when your engine goes bad? Trick question. It kind of doesn't. We get good at making them, and then, you know, and engines do go wrong a lot more often than batteries. But battery failure is very rare, but also this crazy supply that we have here. I mean, I think we're just going to keep seeing this idea that battery packs are going to be the super scarce resource that are going to be so expensive, and we'll never, like, the battery packs being produced now may be expensive on the new market, but I think just the glut of capacity means we're going to have plenty of used EV batteries around. Already you can, you know, I've seen examples of Model 3 batteries where people have swapped them out in a, you know, secondhand shop for $4,000 and things like that. So I'm super stoked about the fact that EV depreciation is continuing, despite the fact that EV reliability keeps getting better. So cars are getting cheaper, and they're also proving to be better in the long term.
Yeah.
So I'm super
cheaper
stoked
and easier to have for a longer amount of time. So
yep.
that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I have a plus as well, and it is Waymo again. I feel like about once a month, my plus is Waymo, because they just like keep announcing.
Yeah, they're going.
You know, they just keep having like great announcements all the time. They're just in this period of explosive growth. Waymo is officially letting its robo-taxis get onto freeways in San Francisco, LA, and Phoenix. So in the Bay Area, you can go all the way to San Jose, which is pretty cool, because before they were just, you know, limited to city streets. Now you can go a lot farther, especially in a place like California where you need that to actually get places.
Yeah, I think that's a huge deal too, especially in the wake of their recent announcements of expanding to other cities, including Detroit and San Diego.
You're gonna have Waymos.
I'm gonna have Waymos. And I was just thinking about, I mean, it's just like San Diego's not San Francisco or even LA. Like LA, you know, the freeways are really important, but a lot of the travel is intra-neighborhood or whatever. San Diego is an extremely car-heavy city with a lot of highways. Same as Detroit. Like, you can't operate in the Midwest a robo-taxi service that doesn't go on highways. It just doesn't. I mean, there's no meaningful traffic. You know, so I think it's absolutely essential to their long-term expansion. And a lot of these things that I felt like were going to be maybe longer delays, for instance, expanding to a city like Detroit, where they're going to have to deal with winter weather, those barriers are falling down very quickly. So I'm super stoked about that. And I think they'll probably be a plus in not that long, because I'll get my first San Diego Waymo, and I'm so excited. I get so carsick to the point where, like, when me and Meg go to concerts, the last time we went, even though we were going downtown, I just drove and paid like $35 for parking, because we had like three concerts within a week. And I'm like, if I have to drunkenly get in the back of one more Uber with a driver who does not know how their throttle pedal works, I'm going to lose my mind.
Tesla driver. People complain about the EV Ubers.
Yeah, they're bad. Yeah, but just in general, people are so, I mean, that's part of what is making me more excited about the robo-taxi thing. I mean, just the average driver, they're not that hard of a benchmark to beat. And even Tesla FSD was so much smoother at the stop signs in my neighborhood than most of my Ubers are.
Yeah. Have you been in a Waymo?
I've been in a Waymo. Yeah. When I was up in San Francisco last time I saw you.
They're pretty freaking smooth. Like, they're very good drivers.
I know.
Surprisingly. They've gotten better.
there also, I hope that the San Diego ones are still iPaces, because an Uber with Meridian audio that you can control yourself, like when I was in the Waymos in San Francisco, I was blasting music, having a great old time. So I hope we get those instead of, I mean, I don't want Ioniq 5s. No hate to the Ioniq 5. It's the iPace is just such a vibe, man.
I think they might be the Zeekers.
I would like to see
the Zeekers. Which will also be cool.
Sure. Yeah.
All right. Mac, again, thanks so much for joining. Otherwise, it would have just been like me talking here. So
I would have loved that. You have such a beautiful voice. You have the voice for radio for sure.
Thanks for listening to the Plugged In podcast from Inside EVs. We'll be back next Friday as always. Today's show was produced by Michael Perkins and brought to you by the Motorsport Network. Make sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe to the Inside EVs YouTube channel, and check out all our latest coverage at InsideEVs.com. See you next time.